Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, now that somebody has copyrighted your name, should I be referring to you as the artist formerly known as Jazza?
Oh my god, Jimmy, I actually have no idea, and I'm kind of scared about the legal implications of it, so I don't know if we should be talking about it. So there's this guy, a really successful YouTuber in Australia called Draw with Jazza, who has copyrighted the name Jazza.
His name's not actually Jazza, though, is it?
No, his name isn't even fucking Jazza. His name is Josiah Brooks, but in Australia, the name Jazza is a common shortened nickname for names that begin with J, A, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I really am. A guy has copyrighted my name, and I don't. I tweeted saying I don't know how I feel about it, but I'm pretty sure how I feel about it. I feel pretty shit about it.
So you said his name was Josiah. Is that
Josiah,
right?
Josiah. Yeah.
So his name should be Jozza, if anything.
Yeah, shall I let him know?
Yeah, I think you should file a countersuit somewhere.
I do not like this whatsoever. Yeah. I do have the thing where lots of people assume that Jazza is my nickname, and I guess if it were a nickname, I wouldn't have really grounds to be quite so precious about it. But it is my real life birth given name. I've never been called anything else in my life.
And presumably there's a birth certificate somewhere that says as much.
Oh, I fucking hope so, because that might be significant in the legal proceedings.
It might be, yeah. Okay, well, as you say, we probably shouldn't discuss them any further.
Yeah, I know!
But Jazza, how have you been? It's been 2 weeks, I think, since we last chatted. You've moved house, haven't you?
I have. I've accidentally, permanently emigrated to Portugal. My brother, my brother lives out here, and so for a while I've wanted to come out and visit, and I came out and visit. It just so happens that it was a week before the UK, England went back into kind of like a nationwide lockdown. I don't know if I'm going to be able to leave. But Portugal has its own kind of restrictions. At the moment, we're under a mini lockdown where we're not meant to leave our municipality. So, but it's a lot less. It's a lot less kind of like intense.
Is a municipality.
You can still go out to the bar, and you can still go out to like a restaurant and stuff like that. You have to wear face masks in public places, which seems to be more of a European thing, like wearing masks outside.
As in just walking down the street and so on.
Yeah, there's technicalities to it. Like, you're meant to wear a mask if you cannot maintain 2 meters social distance outside. But lots of people are interpreting that as I just have to wear a mask. I'll be honest, I'm quite happy that I'm avoiding the England lockdown, though, because that sounds like it is not going to be fun.
I mean, that's a good segue into the three topics that we're going to be discussing this week, the second of which is going to be the English lockdown. Yesterday,
it's the English lockdown.
Does that work?
Sorry. Move on, quick.
So yesterday, as in Halloween, appropriately enough, and I'm sure some of the papers have had fun with that, in an ever-delayed press conference, Boris Johnson and his team of scientists announced that England will be effectively going down to the same lockdown that we were in originally, except that schools will stay open. So there's a few more specifics that I think the support bubble thing still applies, but all the fun places like pubs, restaurants and gyms, if you consider those fun, will be shut down. Non-essential shops and places of worship, they're all no longer an option, but at least the kids are allowed to go to school. Jazza, as you've already said, you're very happy that you've avoided this lockdown. Do you think if it lifts, you'll be considering coming home for Christmas?
Well, I always intended on coming home for Christmas, and I hope I can. Like, I was planning on coming back, isolating for 2 weeks, and then we could actually probably have something close to a normal Christmas. It's going to be really different to last time, I think, because the last time we went into lockdown, it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Jimmy, it was like mid to late March, right?
That's right, yeah.
And the weather was getting warmer, you could probably legitimately spend time outside, you could kind of like go and hang out in a park and stuff like that. That is not going to be as much fun in like November as it was in April.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
I think there's going to be, I think there's going to be a big return to like the Zoom pub quiz.
Yeah, I think the saddest thing is that it means that bonfire nights will have to be cancelled, which means we will, you know, not be able to celebrate our annual anti-Catholic tendencies, which is devastating, mm-hmm. I think, for the country as a whole.
I'm not sure I am. I mean, who doesn't love burning effigies of people that they don't like? But yeah, I think maybe a year off of bonfire night will not be the worst thing possible for the Brits.
So something that we are going to be discussing, probably, you know, in addition to bonfire night, is the bonfire of the Tories' reputation for competence. I noticed that Matt Chorley, that was a good segue, give you that.
It was very good, well done. Yeah,
Matt Chorley tweeted out that Conservative minister, and this is Matt Chorley of the Times, has described the incompetence as, quote, another level, a deliberate destruction of the Tory party. That admittedly was a question. But it's kind of interesting because Boris Johnson there seems to have been sort of wave and wave of different types of regulations. We just had the free tier system come in. And around the country, you know, in various places such as London, it went up to high level or tier two. In parts of the north, it went up to tier three. And there was the whole showdown between Andy Burnham, the mayor of Manchester, and Boris Johnson. And, you know, despite all that wrangling and stuff, we've now just imposed a unilateral national lockdown across England.
Well, we assume so because it actually has to go through Parliament first, doesn't
it? That is,
so it'll
that
be
is
interesting
true.
To see in the next couple of days. We're recording this on November the 1st, which is a Sunday. We expect to see kind of like how this is actually going. Basically, the press conference we had from Boris Johnson yesterday was, here is my intent. Please let me do this. And we'll see. It looks like he's going to have a lot of people in the Conservative Party who are expecting to rebel against him, but probably will pass the majority of things, maybe with some amendments, with Labour support, because they've been in favour of a nationwide lockdown for a couple of weeks.
Okay, we'll get more into the weeds of that in a little bit.
100%.
Jazza, what was the other sort of big UK political story this week that we're going to be touching on?
Oh my God, well, I really... Sometimes I love it when there's kind of like a really great political story because it's so clear that the political journalists in the UK are just having the time of their life. I was listening to PM on Radio 4, I believe, what day was it? What day did this happen? Was it Monday or Tuesday?
It was definitely a day of the week.
It was one of the days of the week, and it was just after the Equality and Human Rights Commission report had been published on anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And within the space of about 3 or 4 hours, we went from the report being published to Jeremy Corbyn saying that some of the stuff around anti-Semitism is exaggerated, to Keir Starmer making a statement about it and basically grovelling, to Jeremy Corbyn being suspended from the Labour Party. And I was listening to PM, and the glee with which the presenter said, in a day of high political drama, Jeremy Corbyn has been suspended from the Labour Party. And I just really, I thoroughly enjoyed the joy that political reporter was having.
I mean, it must be difficult delivering the news when you have a storming erection.
Yes, that's all I can imagine, very really. Fair. It was a woman though, Jimmy. So
still applies.
Does it? Sure. But
female anatomy. Who knows?
But the yeah, I think it's almost kind of like, and other commentators have said this. It's a shame that Corbyn sacking has kind of become the story, and the factionalism within the Labour Party has become the story rather than the anti-Semitism that Labour has been found to unlawfully have taken part in and done. But yeah, how can you not ignore the fact that the former leader of the Labour Party has been suspended by the party that he used to run? Like, that's pretty,
I mean, I haven't checked this, so this is a wild assertion, but I would assume that's a first for certainly in modern, in sort of post World War II political history. I can't really imagine.
Yeah, I remember it was a really big deal when Ken Livingstone was suspended, because he was obviously the mayor of London, and that's probably the highest up person in the Labour Party for that to kind of like have happened to in recent times, at the very least. A couple of years ago, when he talked about, I mean, Hitler and Zionism, which is always a fun topic, isn't it?
Yeah.
But him, I remember how big a deal that was a few years ago, but this just kind of blows it out of the water. And how can we not enjoy a little bit of political scandal?
Indeed. Speaking of scandal, for the third topic, we are going to be discussing, at Jazz's behest, me leaving Twitter, which...
I mean, don't blame me. You're the one who's, like, done a Twitter post and a blog post about it, saying, guys, I'm leaving Twitter.
I don't think writing a blog post is, you know, particularly noteworthy. I mean, it was sort of in connection. It was a kind of semi-review of the social dilemma. So I think it was a relevant framing device. I stand behind it. Yeah, I mean, you seem quite offended that I've announced that I'm leaving Twitter rather than just leaving Twitter.
No, I just find it quite funny, because you have in the past literally taken the piss out of people who announce their leaving of social media on social media quite so publicly.
And yeah, that is legit.
And now you've made a tweet about it, you've made a blog post about it, and now we have a podcast episode about it. And so I just kind of really want to rinse this as much as possible out of you. But actually, to be fair, I think some of the points that you make are very good. You made some interesting things and put them in text. Well, done.
That is a very generous concession, Jazza. But before we, you know, spoil the podcast any further, maybe we should play some music, ask 100% people for donations, and, you know, do that whole thing.
Great, thank you.
The Right Dishonourable podcast is and will remain free to listen to for the foreseeable future, but that doesn't mean we're not happy to take some of your money off you if you're willing to give it to us. If you'd like to do that, please go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable, where you'll find all the necessary details. As always, we would like to thank our current sponsors, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O, and Matt. Thank you very much for continuing to support the podcast, and we hope that you continue to enjoy it.
So, Jimmy, as now you're our English correspondent now, seeing as I'm no longer in the country.
It's a surprise promotion for me here.
Yeah, congratulations. Stick it in your, not in your Twitter bio anymore. How is this actually going to affect your personal day-to-day, the New England-wide restrictions, as somebody who lives in London?
Well, quite devastatingly, I've had to cancel my Pret subscription, which I was enjoying, but obviously if the Pret's are closed...
This is free, you pay a monthly fee for a coffee?
So it's £20 a month, and in theory you can get 5 coffees a day, which, you know, bemusingly includes like the Frappuccino things that they do, and also the smoothies. I've no idea how they're making money out of this, because the first month is free as well, so effectively they've just given me a bunch of free coffees, and I haven't paid them a thing, and the only thing they've got out of it is the occasional purchase of a croissant. But, you know, given that the...
So are you not going to be able to do that anymore? Because places are still going to be open for takeaways, right?
I don't know what the situation is in Prep, but the main reason is that I'm assuming I will no longer be going back to the office. Because you might recall, several weeks ago, the Tories were like, you guys need to go back to the office so that you can buy Pret sandwiches again and, you know, get the economy going. So I was, you know, dutifully, I wouldn't say buying Pret stuff, but, you know, I was consuming it, which has to count for something. Now it, you know, as we said at the top, all the pubs and food places are going to be closed. I think you can have takeaways. You are right, and I remember sort of in the dying days of the original lockdown, there were some pubs that weren't open properly but were serving beer out the window.
Yeah, that you could get kind of like, there were a couple of places near me where you could basically just fill up a tankard and take it home with you. Which I don't know how off licensing rules. They must have applied for an off license, because obviously they are treated differently. But yeah, that's that kind of like from a lot of my friends who are who are in the UK at the moment. Like at the moment, all of my WhatsApp groups are full of people trying to get in their socializing as much as possible before Thursday.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty much my game plan as well. So I'm going to be permanently drunk for the next 4 days, I think.
I'm really proud of you.
A rare moment of sobriety.
Well done.
In a general haze. But yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned it earlier that when the original lockdown came in, the weather was just brightening up. And the weather is relatively grim. Here at the moment, we're only in November, so it's only really starting. But there's going to be much less incentive to like go to the park and just chill out with a couple of beers, you know, as if you're 14 years old again. You're just going to be cooped up in your homes, really. So I think it's, I mean, the way this was framed by Boris Johnson and co is that it's an attempt to save Christmas, almost. Like if we have this lockdown now, then things at the R rate will have fallen enough.
I felt like they were distancing themselves pretty much from the idea of this is saving Christmas. Like it was mentioned a couple of times, but anyway, like all of the graphs that they showed were mainly around kind of like NHS capacity and stuff like that. I feel like even with this lockdown lasting for a month or maybe even longer, because it's provisionally a month, right? Christmas is lost, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole point is about NHS capacity at the end of the day. Like if the NHS has enough capacity, you can keep the economy open and society open, because even if people fall sick, they'll be able to get treatment, and so, you know, people won't die in too great numbers, to be slightly morbid about it. I think the trouble is that, you know, so many, I think even Victoria Derbyshire, who's, you know, not the most renegade of figures, she's a BBC journalist, said, you know, I don't really care what the rules are, I'm going to meet up with my family over Christmas.
Because there's over six of them and all of that.
But a lot of people will sympathise with that view, won't they? They'll be like, you know, fuck this, the year has been shit. We're going to go do Christmas anyway. It's only like one meal or one day. But I mean, as you said, I think there's a very, very high risk that Christmas will in fact be cancelled.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is kind of like the, like, this happened with Ramadan as well. Like, Ramadan, the breaking of, the end of Ramadan is kind of like obviously a big event in the Muslim calendar where loads of families kind of like congregate together to eat communally, and people just ignored it. People ignored the restrictions and just celebrated Ramadan anyway. And so I would not be surprised if Christian / agnostic / British families are just going to do the same. And I don't know how much this lockdown is going to necessarily help things.
I mean, on a personal level, my mum is in a sort of at vulnerable category, so me and my girlfriend weren't planning on going back anyway, just because the, you know, whether or not the government says that it was fine, there is still a fairly substantial risk there. But I don't think, you know, as I just said, whatever the rules are kind of doesn't really change that. If we thought it was fine and it was an acceptable risk, we probably would be planning on doing it, I think. And I think that's probably the way most people feel about this. From that point of view, I think that, you know, the government would almost be advised just to let it happen, because it will look very stupid if it tries to impose rules and then they're widely ignored. That will just undermine it.
Yeah, there's Northern Ireland, Wales are already partway through temporary lockdowns that are meant to lift. I think both of them lift sometime in mid-November. England's lockdown obviously is going to potentially last. It's until kind of like the beginning of December. Scotland has yet to go into a proper national lockdown, but they have released a five-tier system, of course, incredibly and importantly distinctive from from England's three-tier system. Have you read through the Scottish tiering?
I was actually looking at it briefly before we came here. I mean, you sort of implied it slightly. There is the suspicion that Nicola Sturgeon just sets out mildly different rules to distinguish herself.
100%. No, of course they do that. And I understand their modus operandi of why they do that. But I think objectively, Like Scotland is in a different position because it's a lot less densely populated than England is. Because of that, a lot of this can be, a lot of that kind of like population control can be a lot easier. But five levels is too many. There's too many kind of like nuanced differences between them. And it was something that the UK government was kind of like criticised for was, remember the five levels that we had?
What happened to that anyway? Somebody needs to find out, I think. What did happen to that?
Yeah. But there's, in Scotland, there is kind of like this, I don't know, I would be somewhat frustrated, I think, if I were in the North and seeing Andy Burnham kind of like try and jostle up against the Prime Minister, and maybe the same in Scotland, although Scotland has an awful lot more flexibility because its cases and its capacity is higher and its cases are lower.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole reasoning about the sort of local lockdown system, is that different places face different sets of risks and therefore needed, you know, some level of adjustment there. But, you know, the government has sort of just swept that all across the table and just gone. I mean, England accounts for, I think someone was saying, 80-85% of the UK's population. So you sort of as near as got the whole of the UK is now under one lockdown system, which I'd have thought, I mean, it has the benefits of being simple, which I think is good. But if you're living in somewhere slightly obscure, you know, it seems a little bit perverse that, you know, some rural town somewhere that has, you know, 100 people living in it faces the same level of restriction as, you know, central London, basically. So it seems a little bit counterintuitive. But, you know, maybe the simplicity of it and the sense that we are all in this together, rather than having, you know, people like Andy Burnham say, oh, the South doesn't give a shit about the North, maybe that is better overall.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's plenty of quotes that I can use from you, Jimmy, to back up the South doesn't care about the North rhetoric.
I would just raise the fact that I think it was last year, it might have been 2018, but there was a point at which large parts of the North were on fire and the UK was running a story about London was running a story about train delays or something like that. I think that sort of summarises it, really.
100%. There is kind of like a school of thought, and many backbenchers, especially in the Conservative Party, really see this as a tragedy that there are kind of like going to be these restrictions on kind of like commerce and jobs and those kinds of things, especially among kind of the young who are less likely to be severely affected or to be hospitalised or things from this virus. Do you think that has any legs at the minute, as kind of like an argument that could scupper the desire to go into lockdown?
I think there's definitely, if you're of our age group and younger, you probably don't know anyone who's of your age who's been severely affected by COVID. And yes, there are cases where, you know, a 22-year-old will have to go into an intensive care unit with COVID. That does happen. But it's clear that we are less at risk than, you know, someone who's over 60, say. It does feel maybe a little bit unnecessary. I kind of think the other side of that argument is that the imposing a wholesale lockdown against every age group is kind of like the socialization of risk, i.e. because everybody's locked down, it means that if you're from a more vulnerable group, you will be safer when things open up again than if only vulnerable people were asked to shield and then everyone else went about their daily business. So it is in effect, you know, the practical implementation of the phrase, we're all in this together. I get the frustration. I mean, you sort of see some of the stories about university life, and I have to think it must be pretty shit being a student right now.
And having paid that much money to I think people have been absolutely ripped off. I wouldn't be surprised if there's legal action taken down the line.
I wouldn't know about that. I would only say that university debt is not really the same as most other forms of debt, but it probably doesn't feel like that to students.
No, sure, 100%, but you're still being ripped off. Even if like university debt is different, you are being charged the same amount that people have been charged where they have kind of like, they have a real university experience. You are not getting that experience that you were sold.
Yeah.
Kind of like regardless of the debt you're getting, I think there's an argument to be had for you've been duped a little bit and you've gotten the short straw.
I was down in Brighton recently and there was a I think it was some sort of communist party that had a banner out saying $9,000 for Zoom lectures or something like that, and yeah, I think it's hard to
a subscription to Masterclass is considerably cheaper.
You heard it here first, students who listen to this podcast.
Yeah, why not? Why don't you just do that, students? Who needs to read philosophy?
Maybe you should just go on the Great Courses Plus or one of those services.
Coursera as well,
learn how to sew, or I don't know what years you can learn on those
learn
sites.
Learn how to code. Oh, you're one of those. Yes, coding. That,
have you considered a career in cyber? I think before we kind of move on from this, I think that and Andy, we sort of referenced the North earlier, and Andy Burnham, who had this kind of standoff with the government over £5 million that he thought was necessary in order to protect people who weren't able to work during what was then tier three lockdowns for Greater Manchester. And he's justifiably pissed that, you know, a couple of days later the government said, okay, we're going to lock down everywhere and we're going to extend the furlough scheme. It does give off the impression that, you know, the Tories have a pro-Southern bias and they don't really give a shit about the North, and that probably is true to some degree. In a wider sense, I think that Andy Burnham has probably done an awful lot for the case for devolution to English cities over the course of the past couple of weeks. He's, I mean, in a straightforward sense, he hasn't really got what he wanted, but he's been able to sort of delay and hold
raise
up
his profile,
government. Yeah,
really.
And raise his own profile. I think he's...
We've all fallen in love with his beautiful eyes all over again. It's great.
Yeah, so we actually, as a topic for this podcast, we discussed this, I think it was in Vogue, this article. It was essentially a rehash of the whole Dishy Rishi thing, when, you know...
But with
Flora Gill.
No, what was I was going to say, like Handy Andy or something, but
Handy
that's
Handy Andy.
Yeah, that just sounds rapey,
that
doesn't it?
That does sound, yeah, a little bit creepy. I think he'll be keen to distance himself from that. Is Andy Burnham that sexy, though? I mean...
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, can confirm. As a representative for the androphilic people of the world, Andy Burnham's beautiful.
Don't you think there is something like... Just, I mean, now it's been done, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's a bit like as soon as a politician comes on TV saying something that you like, and so long as he's fairly easy on the eye, there'll be a female journalist somewhere who'll think, oh, I can write an article about this.
I don't know how much the journalism label
applies
to me.
Applies to you. I thought you were going to say applies to the authors of these articles.
Applies to me. But as far as I'm concerned, I am always more than happy to objectify a male politician. I think it's incredibly subversive. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I think the flip side of it is I don't think there are that many attractive female politicians in the UK. Although in Scandinavia, for some reason, just seems to have loads of them. Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Talking about attractive politicians. Oh God, no.
No, Keir Starmer doesn't do it for you.
Well, Keir Starmer is kind of like generic chin man, isn't he? Mm. He's like the Disney Pixar's idea of what a president looks like.
He does have that sort of face. Now that you've said that, I'm going to find it very difficult not to see that every time I see him.
You're welcome. I've ruined your life. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So earlier this week, the Equality and Human Rights Commission published their report that they started in May last year, surrounding anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, alleged anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and they found the Labour Party responsible for unlawful acts of harassment and discrimination, specifically three breaches of the Equality Act. where there was political interference in anti-Semitism complaints. Basically, there was no real formalized process of this is how every single complaint has to be dealt with. And sometimes there were cases in the Labour Party where they were dealt with more seriously just because of the potential for there being media interest in the story. The second breach is a failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints. The system was broken, essentially. They had no standardised way of dealing with it. And then two actual forms of harassment, one from Ken Livingstone and one from a Labour councillor called Pam Bromley, both of whom said shit stuff about Jewish people. Anyway,
okay.
just to put it broadly.
Yeah, fair enough.
This was a really serious report. The only time that the EHRC has ever published anything similar and found such damning evidence on a UK-wide political party was with the British National Party. And some of them are literally Nazis. Mm. So that is pretty damning for the political party that prides itself in having a history of equality, human rights, and anti-racism at its core, essentially.
And has strong historic connections to Jewish people in the UK as well.
Yeah, 100%. That isn't to say that other parties do not have problems with other demographics. See, the Conservatives and Islam.
Can we pick up on that point? Because, what happens in a lot of the... I mean, it's happened throughout sort of Jeremy Corbyn's tenure as leader and with Labour more broadly, is that when any criticism is levelled against Labour, particularly in terms of racism, supporters and defenders will immediately turn around and say, oh, but what about the Tory party in Islam?
Yeah, it's whataboutism.
It is whataboutism.
And both of those things can be problems, but it doesn't negate the problem that has been highlighted. So obviously, I think also we have an independent report now that says that anti-Semitism really was a problem and it was dealt with badly by the Labour Party and by the leader of the opposition.
But it will undermine this report that the Tories have not been investigated for Islamophobia, given that people like Baroness Varsi, who is a Tory peer, has accused them of similar problems essentially to Labour and anti-Semitism.
I'll be honest, I don't know enough about what has been instigated on kind of like the Conservative side of things.
There have been various talks of investigations. I think Sajid Javid at one stage during the leadership debate.
Yeah, he was like, he said he would back it and he tried to get everybody else on stage to back it. I feel like COVID-19 has maybe taken over, taken over in terms of priority. Boris Johnson has said that he will do will commission an investigation, an external investigation into anti-Islam, anti-Muslim, anti-Islamophobic. There you go. So.
Is that what you were reaching for?
I thought you were just
picking all the relevant terms.
It's very annoying that it's anti-Semitic but Islamophobic. Like, I want there to be more parity between those. But
it's the English language for you, mate.
So Labour has until the 10th of... So there was that case, and I think Keir Starmer in some ways had a relatively easy task of, I just need to distance myself from the actions that were taken when I wasn't leader.
And he did that, didn't he?
And he did that pretty well. But also, Jeremy Corbyn pops up and says, I agree with the implementations and what needs to happen in that in the report and what the conclusions are in the report. And he should have really just stopped talking at that point, because then he went on to say, but I do want to say, anti-Semitism was politicised, it was exaggerated by media outlets and by opponents of mine within the Labour Party. He then went on to cite a Servation poll from like 2 or 3 years ago. He cited it incorrectly, saying that...
I wondered what this poll was, so I wondered if he had cited the numbers correctly. So he said that a third of Labour Party members were felt to be under suspicion of anti-Semitism according to public perception in this poll, where in fact only 0.3% were actually going through an investigations process. What were the real numbers?
So neither of those numbers are... I mean, they are potentially true, but neither of them really are incredibly accurate. There's nuance in the numbers. Surprise, right. Surprise. First of all, you should never take a single poll and say and kind of like assume that that is the status quo is a snapshot of
a moment.
Of a group of people at a specific time, and also the questioning and stuff can really affect people's responses, and so you should always take a single poll's findings with a pinch of salt, or at least understand what the processes are around that poll to be able to kind of like see how much you need to hedge your bets when you're fact checking it. So Channel 4's fact check actually did a really good breakdown of this, of the poll. So basically, it found that about a third of it was a good sample size, about 1,000 people, about a third of the people who had responded to the poll said that they hadn't heard anything about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. The third of those who said that they had... also said that they didn't know about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. So actually those that responded yes were actually only representative, that third is only representative of a third of responses to that survey.
So you're saying only a ninth of people thought that...
In this survey, yes, that's correct.
Thought that Labour Party members were under suspicion.
Basically, Corbyn cited the people that responded to the survey in the affirmative, saying that they had heard of anti-Semitism
in the Labour Party. I mean, that's just being aware of it as a general allegation. Then that's not. That doesn't reflect what he said at all.
Yeah, and so, but then he cited like a third of those who responded in the positive, saying I've heard of it, then said that like the largest response was kind of like, oh, I reckon 34%.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, that is quite different from what he said.
It is different to what he said, and then also he said that 0.3%. Rather than a third, 0.3% were under investigation. Mm. No one's really sure where he got this 0.3% from.
Right.
Because actually one of the critiques of the Labour Party from this report said that one of the problems was that Labour didn't have a really clear and centralised way of being able to track these complaints. And even if... this were true, if we assume that this number of 0.3% is correct, the Labour Party has over 580,000 members, from what I understand. 0.3% of their membership being under investigation is over 1,700 individuals.
I think the membership numbers were higher at certain points in Corbyn's reign, so... You know, depending on
but
what
it's
point
like,
he's
but
talking
when,
about,
but
it could
you can
be
say
higher than that.
0.3%, and it sounds like a tiny number. But when you think about the absolute numbers of there were over, if this is true, and we don't have evidence that this is true, over 1,000 people were under investigation. That, regardless as to what the percentage is, that's still pretty fucking high.
And also, as you kind of implied, 0.3% is merely the number of people who somebody has filed a proper complaint against.
Yes.
The numbers who, you know, did something bad could potentially be higher than that. It's, you know, the numbers that did something bad but were never caught, or, you know, nobody ever actually registered it as being a problem, could also be higher than that. So
mm-hmm. and by saying this, Jeremy Corbyn, by saying that a lot of the anti-Semitism was exaggerated, it went against really quite starkly what Keir Starmer said in his statement in response to the report. Where Starmer said some people will say that it's exaggerated, but actually I want to take it very seriously. But those who say it's exaggerated are part of the problem. And Jeremy Corbyn had literally just said that it was exaggerated. And by saying it's exaggerated, it allows people who are aligned with him to not take this report very seriously. He should have really just said, this is a terrible thing and I support all of the responses. And then he would not have been kicked out by the Labour Party. And kind of like an important thing, I made this mistake on Twitter. I said that Keir Starmer kicked him out of the Labour Party. It was actually the Labour Party itself, the leadership that kicked Jeremy Corbyn out. It wasn't a Keir Starmer decision.
By the leadership, you mean the Whip's office or was it the actual sort of administrative chief of Labour? Is that right?
I think it's
the president of Labour.
Yeah, the equivalent of the CEO, whatever that is. Yeah, I can't remember the actual title.
So I feel there should be some defence of Corbyn, and I'm going to give it, and I think you're going to raise
your eyebrows. Go on then, Navarra Media, go for it.
I think it is true that there was a point at which coverage of Labour was very, very focused on the anti-Semitism problem. You can argue as to whether that was justified or not, but I think that, you know, when he says it was exaggerated, I think you can defend that only in the sense that there was a point at which it was the only thing that was being talked about in relation to Labour. And, you know, Labour is much more than its anti-Semitism problem, even under Jeremy Corbyn. So I think in that sense, he might be right. He's also correct, I think, that there is a factional element to the anti-Semitism complaint. And that's not me trying to say that the people complaining about anti-Semitism are wrong or incorrect. It's just that it did become a point at which critics of Corbyn were using it to unseat him. And that, you know, that's politics, right? Like,
I think that is correct as well. I would agree with that. However, when you have a report released that says there was a lack of willingness to tackle anti-Semitism rather than an inability to do so, and there are so many Jewish individuals, people like Luciana Berger, who felt so at odds with the leadership of the Labour Party that she left the party that she gave so many years of her life to because she didn't feel like she could be both a Labour politician and a Jewish woman. I feel like when people are having to make those kinds of decisions, she's not making that decision for political reasons. That's a deep personal decision. You should probably listen to those people when they say they're being harassed. And they weren't listened to.
So kind of on that point, Keir Starmer has sort of distanced himself from, you know, the previous leadership, and he said, you know, we'll implement these recommendations of the report in full. And essentially he's accepted everything the report has said. He was a prominent member of Corbyn's cabinet. He was the
Shadow Brexit secretary.
And, actually, his job title sort of understates how important he was. He was one of the foremost members of Corbyn's team, basically. And even allowing for the fact that I don't get the impression he was a member of Corbyn's inner circle because he wasn't seen as, you know, left-wing enough in a way, and he was slightly outside the leader of the opposition's office.
His chin was too big. He couldn't fit through the door.
Yeah, something like that. For him to have campaigned to put Jeremy Corbyn in office, where he must have known a significant amount of what this report saying was true, you know, partly because of people like Luciana Berger making the complaints that she did. It's, I mean, in some ways, I feel like he shouldn't get well out of, you know, get out of this at all on good terms, really, because he was somebody who advocated for Jeremy Corbyn to get you know, become prime minister, basically, and he knew most of what this report alleges anyway.
But I think do you not think that the tone that he struck, which was really, it was grovelling, it was this is really bad, and we're going to take all of the recommendations. They need to. They need to, by the 10th of December, draft an action plan. He plans on having that action plan up and running by the new year. I think that is, like, of course there's a certain amount of you have to ask about complicity. Although most of the report focuses on the leader of the opposition's office rather than kind of like his wider cabinet. And I'm also... Yeah, like I think you are right, but I think that with the release of this report, Keir Starmer has done his best to be like, yeah, this is really fucking bad, and we should be really embarrassed about it, and we're going to do everything we can to reverse it.
Well, I think that he, you know, will find a lot of sympathy for his sort of like his actions. You know, a lot of people will be like, okay, he's taking this seriously. He's doing what we want. And I think his reputation, his control of the party will be enhanced ultimately by the events of the last week. I just don't think that's really right. I mean, I think that he is essentially complicit in it, not in that he actually did any of the things that you know, personally, that Labour are accused of doing, but just in the fact that he was willing to stand by Corbyn when all of this was going on and was going on publicly. You know, this is stuff that we knew about and discussed on this podcast. So
I will say that Corbyn doesn't actually get talked about or blamed for anything specifically personally. The suspension of him from the Labour Party was very much in response to the way that he responded to the report.
That is true, but it did all happen under his watch. There's a lot of stuff about the leader of the opposition's office.
Yeah, 100%. But I think that a certain amount of it is he really was just incompetent, wasn't he? He wasn't very good at being leader.
So, something that sort of strikes me about all this, that there, as you say, there is actually a lack of a smoking gun in terms of Corbyn's own anti-Semitism. Luciana Berger has said that she thinks that he's an anti-Semite. He went to the reflaying for the Munich terrorists, which I think is, at the very least, shows that he hates Israel in a kind of fairly visceral sense, which isn't the same thing as hating Jewish people. And he said that weird comment about British Jews not getting irony, which is anti-Semitic. I mean, that just straightforwardly is. But it's sort of hard to imagine him as like a, you know, spit-soaked racist in the pub, you know, moaning
about.
No,
but that's not what racism... That's so rarely what racism looks like in the modern world. The type of racism that you talk about, the National Front member or the more polished and more socially acceptable BNP. That's not what racism looks like at the moment. It is
more
something
that
is baked in, and people who are racist, I think, very rarely think of themselves as racist. And so that makes actually the conversations that you have around it and the accusations that we make so much harder to have, because nobody overtly thinks, oh yeah, I'm better than somebody because of their race, or this person's race makes them bad. And they will always have kind of like a black friend or a Jewish friend that legitimates their lack of racism. But that stuff like something that's clearly under the surface for Corbyn, where he talks about British Jews not getting irony because they're not British. Essentially, that's what he was subconsciously expressing, right?
But I mean, I think this whole... I sort of get your point around racism can be a bit more subtle, but I think sometimes certain allegations in relation to that can be unfalsifiable. You know, you're sort of just insinuating something that may be true. You know, maybe in some subconscious sense, Jeremy Corbyn does hate Jewish people, but it's very hard to prove, and I think it's not necessarily that productive to have a conversation about it, really. Well, I mean, what is obvious is that he either wasn't aware because he wasn't paying attention, which you know, is a sackable offence in someone who's the leader of a party, or he was aware.
Gross
and he didn't
negligence,
care.
Essentially.
So yeah, I mean, it was obvious he was unsuited to be leader of the Labour Party for quite a long time, for, you know, reasons going beyond this particular issue. But I think this has sort of been the nail in the coffin.
What do you think? We are going to see in terms of Corbynites and left wing. Like, it was whenever something anti-Corbyn happens nowadays, I always go straight to Navarra Media, and it was fascinating to see them bend over. Like, they opened a live stream the evening that he was suspended. They opened it with that Jeremy Corbyn was suspended from the Labour Party for telling the truth, and I mean. You do Navarra, but fucking hell. And I've seen kind of like some rumours around like the hard left MPs, those that were kind of like brought in under Jeremy Corbyn. They're maybe divorcing themselves from the party if Jeremy Corbyn isn't reinstated. I think there's no chance of him being reinstated, just to
That was what I was going to ask, is that you know, the Labour Party have suspended Jeremy Corbyn, so effectively he's not really a member of the Labour Party as it stands, and they're going to investigate. I don't know what exactly this investigation is going to entail, because, you know, he said what he said.
It's all out on the table. Right?
He's not going to backtrack. I mean, that is probably the one thing that we know about Jeremy Corbyn above all else, is that he does not relent. He's, you know, stubborn, and in some ways that's what people like about him. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that in a purely negative sense, but he's not going to come out in a week's time and say, I regret what I said. You know, I shouldn't have diminished the complaints that have been made by Jewish people. I'm sorry for the upset that I caused, and I will work to improve, you know, things. He's going to stick by this opinion, I'm sure.
Yeah, I agree.
So, I mean, you've already said you think that you think that he's going to be out permanently, sort of like Ken Livingstone.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that does make it really difficult for political movements like Momentum, for media institutions like Navarra. It was really interesting. I can't remember the name of the guy, but one of the founders of Navarra was on Sky News providing commentary.
Aaron Bastani. Maybe,
I can't remember. The one with the black hair, white guy. I don't know. But he was talking about the Labour Party like they were incompetent and unfit to govern.
Right.
And if Navarra media aren't throwing themselves behind the potential of a Labour government, what does that mean for engaging the left wing, the left, if they don't automatically get an endorsement? I think that. I don't know if that's, but I don't think that's potentially a problem for Starmer, because that's not where he needs to win votes. He needs to win votes in the centre. And I think that this is probably going to be long term a really good thing for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually being able to endorse Jeremy Corbyn's suspension from the party was a great thing for Starmer, politically speaking. I think you know, one of the ironies of this is actually if you read a lot of the analysis of Starmer, a lot of people think he's actually more left-wing in principle than he necessarily sounds at the, you know, dispatch box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's actually a lot that Starmer wants to do that would, you know, in pure policy terms, Navarra Media and co. would like. But I think they're so sort of embedded into the whole factionalism thing, you know, the Corbynite versus non-Corbynite, or, you know, the Corbynite versus Starmer's, as the case may be now, that they're never going to relent. And I think that just throughout the whole Corbyn saga, they were so unaware of how toxic he was. Every time that someone said, oh, you know, he has equivocated over the IRA, or, you know, he went to that reflaying, they just downplayed it and denied it. And, you know, some of that is just motivated reasoning and the normal things we see in politics. But at a certain point, you just have to admit that this guy, you know, you could have got somebody elected, I think, on a pretty Corbyn manifesto if they didn't have all the baggage of Corbyn.
Oh, I would be surprised if the next Labour manifesto is very different to the one that was offered up at the end of last year.
Yeah.
You just need somebody who is electable, but they're a personality cult.
I think that's
around somebody with
true.
No fucking personality.
I mean, that sort of, in some ways, that's preferable to the other type of personality cult, I think.
That's probably fair.
Still not good. I think, you know, there was a point at which Navarra Media were actually, as you say, they were getting invited on Sky News and BBC and all the rest of it, and they had genuine clout because people felt they had an ear into the Labour leadership. I think their own fortunes as a kind of media outlet are going to wane now that Corbyn has been cast to one side. And I think that's probably for the best, really.
Yeah, I probably agree.
For everyone concerned.
So, Jimmy, speaking about having influence on the wane,
are you talking about the audience numbers for this podcast?
No, I'm talking about your but I'm talking about your influence on Twitter. It is now going to be reduced to next to naught. You are quoted as saying, "What eventually got to me is the stupidity Oh God, the stupidity. It wasn't even the gormless rage of the ill-informed, but the arcane idiocy of the overeducated, pumping drivel into the atmosphere every day, drove me away.
And Jimmy, that's just you, Jazza.
Yeah, Jimmy, why didn't you just at me in that?
You read everything I post on the blog for some reason, so I knew it would get round to you eventually.
When you talk about the stupidity, and you don't necessarily mean kind of like people who are ill-informed, but people who are, and correct me if I'm wrong, who see their opinion as self-important and correct, right? Is that kind of what you're talking about?
I think the thing is about Twitter, and you know, I'm sort of, everything I say is going to be a kind of act of hypocrisy because I'm essentially guilty of everything that I'm going to criticize others for right now. But starting with that disclaimer, I actually really enjoyed Twitter and before it was Reddit for a long time because it was kind of stupid and anarchic, and it is actually really fun, and in some ways it's really enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that I stayed on both of those platforms for several years. And you do learn a lot. I've been off Twitter for 2 months now, and there's stuff that I don't hear about, or that I only hear about because a friend will like text me something. And that there is, you know, insight and genuinely interesting information that you do miss out on. I think that the trouble is that, you know, the signal to noise ratio is very bad, basically. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much stuff you see retweeted that just like pisses you off, or you know, pisses me off personally. I'm confident that you're similar. It's just sort of stupid views, just like people. I mean, you could sort of level this at us, I suppose, in the podcast format, but people variously being pedantic or too literal minded, or just saying stuff that's irrelevant, just isn't like considered. And I think anything that's written in sort of 280 characters and fired off the internet is unlikely to be considered because the medium doesn't really lend itself to that. And I don't know if I referenced this elsewhere in the blog you just quoted from, but Twitter is like perfectly set up for dunking, as in somebody will quote tweet something and go, oh yeah, yeah. And it's like, and for their listeners, if you're a progressive person dunking on a Tory, that will come across as really smart and like snarky, and vice versa, right? So it's just, I think, as I said, it's not entirely negative, but I think over time the negatives for me outweighed the positives. And you know, these days, since actually leaving Twitter, I can't claim that I've done much more productive with my time, but it does mean that I'm reading more actual journalism and actual long form things that are more considered and less rage inducing.
Don't you think there's an awful lot of stupidity in the opinion articles of, say, The Times, The Guardian? Like, we've talked about this before, how so many of the people who have those kinds of platforms, those lucrative platforms, actually have no idea what the fuck they're talking about sometimes. It is just, in the same tense, it's drivel. It's just paid for drivel, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of fairly ill-informed commentary on, like, you know, The Guardian opinion section, The Times, The Spectator, probably the New Statesman, although I haven't really read that for a while. And that is true, but I think the level of stupidity is greater on Twitter because there are at least some barriers to entry to, you can't just publish something on The Guardian. You have to at least go through a commissioning editor somewhere along the line.
Sure.
And it does mean that your thoughts are at least reasonably well formulated, even if you disagree with them. I think it just it cuts out a certain level of dross, even if the substance of the argument is the same. And I think there is a value in that. There's a value in actually seeing arguments put as best they can be, rather than put by the least eloquent people.
I know that this isn't necessarily as possible as I'm about to make it sound, because not everybody on your Twitter timeline is somebody that you follow, because of, like, it will sometimes show you stuff that it thinks that you will find interesting, yeah, and that you will engage with. But do you not think that that's kind of up to you as the user to curate your experience on something like Twitter? Reddit is probably something that's a lot more easier to do that with, right? Because you can literally you curate the Reddit boards that you actually engage with, and you get notifications from, right?
Yeah, so Reddit, for people who don't know, is it's kind of a links aggregator. So you have these little sub forums that you subscribe to around certain subjects, such as UK politics, and then people just post links and there's upvotes and. Do they do downvotes anymore? I can't remember if they do, but essentially the most popular stuff is voted to the top, and then you can see the link, and then there's like a comments page below every link. I mean, for me, that's it, you know, Reddit, I think the trouble with Reddit is it sort of incentivizes not really reading the links, because the comments are really where the amusement is to be found. And there's a lot of like really funny in-jokes, like I've laughed harder at some Reddit comment threads than I have, you know, actual professional funded comedy. So I think there's something to be said for that. But yeah, I just don't think the, you know, there's this cliche, the medium is the message, which essentially means that however a medium is structured, it will emphasize certain things over others. So, you know, I think when that phrase was originally, I can't remember who it's originally attributable to, but it was originally aimed against TV, I think, mm-hmm. Because TV emphasizes the visual over the kind of intellectual, and therefore a lot of stuff ends up being about the quality of the visual image rather than anything else, which is a problem mm-hmm. when you're having discussions about, say, boring policy topics, which are not necessarily well done through the medium of image.
So I don't know, there's some graphics that can help.
Have you, as you've sort of indicated with your criticism of how people use stats, graphics and graphs have their own problems, I think.
Yeah, this is a fair point. But so are the words that people use.
In relation to Twitter, because you were kind of asking about curation.
Sure, yeah.
I think I'd be interested to hear your views on this, actually. I think it's just really difficult to actually remove all of the stupidity and the annoyance from Twitter. So you can choose who you follow, which is a big part of it. You can also mute certain words and certain topics. So I actually, towards like my end of my heavy use of Twitter, I started muting words like mood or something, because, you know, like as in, oh, this is such a mood, because I never wanted to see something that said that, because I just think it's kind of drivel and stupid. So I was going through muting certain things like that to see if I could clean up my Twitter experience, and I don't think it can be done, really, because it's a sort of semi-open platform. As you say, stuff can be retweeted into your timeline. And Twitter, you know, over time, Twitter has sort of tried to flag things like, oh, you might be interested in this. It's like, no, I'm not interested in that.
So yeah, I've never been interested in something that it's tried to suggest me.
Yeah, and so I go around sort of muting certain people that I don't follow so that they're never retweeted into my timeline. And just after a while, you're like, you know, this is... put like it you can't really improve it to a decent enough standard that I think it continues to be worth reading. Although I do see the whole argument around individuals being able to curate their own feeds and stuff, I think ultimately I do believe in editors, which I you know probably would say as a a now former copy editor. But I think editors provide a useful function in terms of sifting information and, you know, presenting stuff, putting stuff in front of you that you know is useful to you or is interesting or is valuable in some way versus just mm-hmm. having the algorithms do it. Maybe in 10 years time Twitter will have come up with a clever enough algorithm that it can actually do that as well as a human editor. I'm a little bit skeptical, but it might be possible. And then maybe I'll return to Twitter, but that's kind of my view on things, really.
Mm-hmm. How much of this do you think is just because you're getting old and grumpy?
I started young and grumpy, so I think the age might not be as significant a factor as all that. But I think there probably is something in that, actually, because I think I've not gone on TikTok.
Yeah, more. I know an awful lot of people who just aren't on Twitter anymore, who have made the active decision to either just use it for work or not have it part of their, like removing it from their home screens so that they don't have it as a go-to. I've been experimenting with that actually, with both Instagram, because I don't think that is very good for my mental health, and I may be doing it with Twitter soon as well. Like, I recently re-downloaded Tinder and quickly deleted it again because, like, it's an appalling... It's an appalling experience. It's so hollow. It encourages you to objectify people, and then there is no incentive for you in the whole, in the infrastructure of Twitter, for people to actually meet. like the experience finishes once you get a match, and so it's terrible. And I think, I mean, like I think TikTok is a really good example of a platform that, I mean, it does kind of like eat away at time, but it is. I very rarely leave TikTok feeling worse about myself, whereas some of the older platforms like Instagram, I very often leave Instagram feeling worse about myself.
I think that's kind of the thing, you know, I've sort of raised a load of intellectual arguments why I think it's worth leaving Twitter, which I guess do matter, but there's a certain point where I just like, this is exhausting. Like,
I'm not having fun, this isn't making me a better person.
I it's just annoying me. And I'm just being pissed off by like people that I'm never going to interact with, that I don't need to interact with for any reason. And not, you know, not to get too self-helpy about it, but I think I can elevate this, as they would say. Barack Obama said something about like you get a certain amount of like willpower juice. I don't think he used the word juice in a given day, and so you have to prioritize what you're going to make decisions about and what you're going to focus on. And at a certain point, it's like this takes up too much focus, and it's not really worth it.
Too much of my willpower juice.
Yeah, too much willpower juice. Well, too much rage juice, I think.
I think I agree with you a lot, but I must say that I would never be presumptive enough to make a grand announcement that I'm leaving Twitter.
I see. You're just going to slink off into the darkness.
Yeah, I'll just slink off.
I sort of semi-slunk, I think.
A Twitter post, a blog post, and now a podcast episode. I just wanted to make it as easy as possible for me to drag you in the future. That's the only reason I suggested this as a topic.
But I think you'll find that I actually quit Twitter for a month before I announced that I'd left. So
you also told us on the podcast that you had quit Twitter for a month.
There you go. I mean, that's I was more just announcing my findings to an expectant audience, really. So now they can. They can absorb my wisdom and, you know, make their own decision, really. I feel like this is a public service, Jazza. This is not self-indulgent in any way.
Okay, so you are the worst. If they want to... Where can they reach out to you now, Jimmy?
Jimmy@rightdishonourable.com.
And you can find me @JazzaJohn on all social media, because I'm still not strong enough to remove myself from it all.
He's still a good internet boy, despite all the interventions that we're trying.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Tell someone about us. Okay, bye.